The next case before us is 20-3252, Bledsoe versus Board of County Commissioners. Please, counsel for appellant, proceed.
May it please the court, I represent Jeff Herrig, Robert Papa, Troy Frost, and Randy Carino, and they are accused of conspiring to frame Mr. Bledsoe with no motive. Qualified immunity should be granted because the allegations in this complaint are not well pled to support six counts against each of these officers. The complaint shows only a sheer possibility that its allegations could have happened, but the complaint does not nudge these claims across the line from conceivable to plausible, as Iqbal requires. So we're going to talk about how the district court erred in three main ways. The district court, most of all, erred by not following the two-pronged approach dictated by Iqbal. First, the district court accepted all the allegations as true, but it didn't identify the allegations that are well pled or identify the allegations that are not entitled to the assumption of truth. And that's a legal issue. There's a difference between challenging whether the allegations are well pled and whether they are true. We have a lot of conclusory allegations that are not well pled in this complaint. And second, the district court refused to assess the plausibility of the allegations, light of a more likely explanation that these four officers were just doing their job based on the information they had at the time. And third, the district court credited all collective allegations on all counts against all defendants, and then misapplied the concept of imputed liability to all the six counts at issue here. So as we ask this court to review this 24 counts at issue here, keep in mind the burden is always on the plaintiff to show how the complaint overcomes the presumption of qualified immunity.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Turner. Are you suggesting that in every case the district court needs to mechanically go through and say, okay, I mean, I noted your methodology in your brief, and it strikes me as being logical. I mean, you decide here are the well-pled allegations, I strike out the ones that aren't, and then I decide whether they're plausible. Well, I mean, does a district court have to expressly do that? And if it does, where is their authority for that?
Iqbal talks about that.
It talks about the fact that that's what is done. I mean, that is the effect. It doesn't say that a court has to mechanically go through and expressly say that I've done that. I mean, I could do that in my head. I mean, I wouldn't have to write. I wouldn't have to strike it out and make it clear that I'm not considering X allegation. So where is for the notion that methodology has to be expressed or explicit? Is there any basis for that?
Well, this circuit has said that legal conclusions, conclusory statements are not entitled to the assumption of truth. So inherent in that statement is the idea that the court should undergo that analysis.
Inherent in that is that that's the substance of what the court should do. It doesn't say the court needs to explicitly do it. But let me ask you the second question. Isn't beyond that, isn't this sort of a tempest in the teapot? Because we're applying de novo review. I mean, so what? I mean, we're called upon to decide whether under qualified immunity, there's a clearly established constitutional violation. Number one, whether there is a constitutional violation pled. And number two, whether there's clearly established law for it. That's our job now. So what difference does it make? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter, does it?
That's absolutely correct. This court can do the same analysis, the same look over the complaint as the district court did without any deference. That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
So let's go through. There are six counts against four officers, and
well, as long as you've got six counts and you don't have enough time to discuss them all, the one that I'm really kind of concerned about is the duty to intervene
Right. With
other officers when they violate constitutional law. I'd like to know your take on whether that law was clearly established at the time of these offenses or not, and your best authority on that.
That law was not absolutely It's absolutely not established. The district court didn't address that. The plaintiffs made no effort to show that that was clearly established. all the failure to intervene cases out there are all excessive force cases. That just does not translate to failure to intervene during a criminal investigation.
Was it raised? Well, I mean, how did you argue the point? Was that an issue that was clearly raised to the court? Did at some point will we find you saying to the court, the duty to intervene, assuming there is one, there is no law clearly establishing that at the time of these events?
We say multiple times that the duty is on the plaintiff.
My question is, did you focus on whether the duty to intervene was clearly established or not at the time of the offense?
I don't believe that was argued below. We did argue.
All right. If it was not argued below, then even though I'm troubled by it, is there a risk that that hasn't been preserved?
One, this court has discretion to address any issue it wants. Two, it was not our burden to make that argument.
And on that point, did the plaintiff argue below that this was a clearly established right?
No, did not.
Because what I saw the district court doing was just saying this is a theory of imputed liability, and it really didn't talk about the whole notion of whether it's a theory of imputed liability that's clearly established or not.
Correct.
All right.
I will point out, you asked for authority that the Third Circuit recently addressed this and found that this type of claim is not clearly established law for the reasons I've said. And that's the Weimer case.
So as I understand it, when we look at this record, there was no argument made below one way or the other about whether the duty to intervene, you know, historically intervene when the events were happening with fellow officers was not or was clearly established. That simply was not specifically presented to the court by either side. Is that your argument?
Correct. And our argument is we didn't have to. It's the court's responsibility and the plaintiff's responsibility to show that it was.
Plaintiff's responsibility.
We have to assert qualified immunity, and we did multiple times. So as an example, the district court said the collective references to all the investigating officers don't make clear who is alleged to have done what to whom to establish the basis for each 1983 claim. But the court didn't dismiss any of the claims against any of these officers. So specific to number one, the claim is fabrication of Tom's testimonial evidence. Herrig, Papa, and Frost are not named in any of the allegations supporting count one. There's no allegation that had any personal involvement. The court recognized that. None of these allegations assert Mr. Herrig fabricated evidence against the plaintiff.
Remind me of count one. Was that a conspiracy claim or a substantive claim?
Count one is a substantive claim specific to the fabrication of Tom's testimonial evidence. Mr. Quetzal's confession.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Turner, on the notion of giving collective allegations, defendants this, defendants that, as opposed to specifically naming defendants. You're familiar with our Pauls case, right? Pauls versus
Correct.
Thomas. Well,
yes.
Part of the evil, it seems to me, that's at play in Pauls and in some of our other cases is that you have people doing quite distinct different things who are under different authority structures. And then when you use the word defendant, it really becomes very unclear what is the universe of misconduct that is being alleged and who falls within that universe. In this instance, couldn't it be argued that you've got a small enough group of people and the fabrication relates to one thing? I mean, it relates to this incrimination of Mr. Bledsoe, that even if it wasn't the best pleading to refer to defendants and defendants this, defendants that, that it was clear, particularly when you use the conspiracy allegation, it was clear that they were talking about all defendants, including Mr. Herring, Misty, and these others.
There are nine defendants total, so I disagree that that is a small number, and they do have all different roles. There are two attorneys. There's another agency involved.
Well, but there are nine. But at the moment, we're really just focusing about the investigators, the Jefferson defendants. So there was allegations that they acted as a coherent team. Is there not? And that even if it wasn't, the word conspiracy was only used in a conspiracy count. Wasn't there general allegations that they all worked as a team on this matter?
I don't believe that was alleged in the complaint necessarily. In fact, Mr. Herrig was not an investigator at the time. He did not testify at the trial. He had very little to do with this.
Well, he didn't testify at the trial, but I maybe count five or one of those counts, there's a conspiracy allegation as it relates to the fabrication of Tom's statement. And if they allege defendants and law enforcement defendants, and they talk about the fabrication, why isn't it a fair inference that they included Mr. Herrick as well as everybody else?
I guess my point would be there's a difference between the substantive counts and the conspiracy counts.
And how does that work? Because you can impute liability, right? Now, there was the Dixon case, I think, that the district court cited. And what isn't, let me ask you two questions on that. Doesn't Dixon provide authority for the imputation? And the second related question is, isn't this just a version of Pinkerton liability that you see in the criminal context where essentially if you've got a conspiracy and they pled that Mr. Herring et al. Were part of a conspiracy, if they're part of a conspiracy, then the acts of each conspirator are attributed to the other in furtherance of the conspiracy. Are they not?
Dixon says that only a conspiracy claim allows for imputed liability. Our argument is count one, count three are not conspiracy claims.
Well, imputed liability means that they were conspirators, which means that the act of every conspirator, I mean, if there is a conspiracy claim and a substantive claim, and the substantive claim and the conspiracy claim says they're conspirators to fabricate evidence, look at count one. And therefore, that means that they're saying that everybody who was in the conspiracy, every act of the conspirators in count one, in furtherance of that fabrication of the evidence, should be imputed to the others. That's how it works, doesn't it? Imputed liability.
The conspiracy claims, we do agree with that.
Well, and let's go further than that. Let's assume there was not a conspiracy claim. Let's assume there was only a count one of specific conduct. But the evidence that was presented was they all acted in conspiracy. Wouldn't it be legitimate for the court to say the evidence of conspiracy is enough to impute the actual conduct of everybody to the same? And so, yes, they're all going to be liable for count one, even though it's not conspiracy.
Liability under conspiracy still requires personal participation in the unlawful.
Yes, but and it would in this case, in the hypothetical I gave you too, before you could impute somebody under count one, when that's the only count that was there, would still, if you're going to rely on somebody who wasn't an actual participant, but only a conspirator, you'd have to put in evidence, I'm sure, that person was a conspirator, or an aider and abettor. Now, I guess you would need an allegation of aider and abettor. Was there an allegation of aiding and abetting in those other counts that were non-conspiratorial counts?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay, thank you.
And at this point, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
That's fine, Ms. Turner.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Ruth Brown representing the plaintiff, Floyd Bledsoe.
Ms. Brown, what do we do with this failure to intervene allegation? I guess there are a couple of questions, obvious ones. One, did you argue before the district court that failure to intervene was clearly established law? And two, is it your view that in fact it is clearly established law in this context?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd like to address both our waiver argument and the merits. And I'll begin with the waiver argument. The district court considered and addressed all of the arguments regarding qualified immunity that were properly raised below. And that's what we did as well. And that included all of the arguments about constitutional violations being clearly established that were apparent from the briefing. And, the defendants concede that they didn't raise this issue below. But there is nonetheless...
That doesn't really get to, you can look very clearly at Cox versus Glantz and other cases that talk about the notion that the burden is on, once the defense is invoked, the burden is on the plaintiff to come forward and show those two prongs originally talked about, notably in Saussure, but in all the qualified immunity cases, that's your burden. You have to show that there's a clearly established law, violation of law. First, there's a constitutional violation. Two, it's clearly established. So what they do, unless you can give me authority to the contrary, what they do becomes secondary importance. You've got the obligation because they've invoked the defense. What do you read Cox differently? And if so, please tell me why.
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because I think that the obligation on the plaintiff is to show that the constitutional violations, which would here be the fabrication of false evidence and the withholding of exculpatory information, were clearly established. What the defendants are asking you to do is look at...
We're talking about a specific claim. That claim is failure to intervene. And the point would be, what is there in the law that says in this context of fabrication of evidence and these other violations you're alluding to, in this context, where is there law that says failure to intervene is a discrete claim? And if so, and that claim is clearly established, where is it that in your briefing that you make that contention?
We didn't make that contention below, and the district court didn't make that contention below. And that is because failure to intervene is not itself a claim.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Well, Your Honor, the way that the plaintiff sees it is that is a theory of liability, and the constitutional claim is the Brady claim and the fabrication claim. But and there are reasons why this court should not reach the failure to intervene claim, and that is because doing so would frustrate appellate procedure for three different reasons. The first reason it would discount the work of the district court and addressing the issues that actually were raised below. It would deprive this court of the reasoned analysis of the district court on a serious question of constitutional law, and it would encourage defendants to pick and choose which qualified immunity arguments to focus on and emphasize below, and which to save for appeal as a fallback position if they didn't gain traction on their primary arguments below.
Let me ask you this, and make sure I understood you correctly. Initially, I thought I heard you say that this is not a discrete claim. I know the district court treated it just as with conspiracy as a vehicle, a means to impute liability. If in fact it is your position that it's not a discrete claim, then it falls away, does it not? It is not relevant to this action.
It is a theory by which the defendants are responsible for constitutional violations. And, if I could turn to the merits of the failure to intervene claim, there was a consensus in the appellate courts by 1999 that law enforcement officers did have an affirmative duty to intervene in constitutional violations by their colleague law enforcement officers. And at Appendix 902, the district court cites a number of cases that actually address this issue before 1999.
And I would wager that almost all of those cases are Fourth Amendment excessive force cases. And are they not?
Some of them are, but some of them are not. And also some of them make clear that the principle that they're applying is not limited to excessive force. And they do that explicitly. So, for example, the Reed v. Wren case cited by the district court, this is 57 F3rd 1081, was a case about seizure of a horse and threats made to somebody regarding a horse. The Young v. Hardin and the Anderson v. Brannon cases cited by the district court at Appendix 902 all expressly say that the duty to intervene extends not just to excessive force, but all constitutional violations. And there's three additional cases I would cite to the court that are not, there's Anderson v. Campbell. This is 104 F3rd 367. That was an unlawful entry into a home case, so it was not an excessive force case. There's Lesby v. TG, which is 749 F2 1423. And that was an excessive force case, but it stated the principle broadly as applying to all constitutional violations by law enforcement officers that are committed within the presence of a law enforcement officer. And the fundamental issue here is that no reasonable homicide investigator would think that it was reasonable to do, to stand by and do nothing over the days and the weeks.
Let me pause a minute. You made an important statement qualifier there. You said that some of these cases say you've got a duty when a violation is occurring in your presence. But at least as to Herrig, who is kind of the overall supervisor, a lot of this stuff wasn't in his presence. So those cases wouldn't be authority even if they are as broad as you suggest they are.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think by in your presence, I'm not sure that that's the exact phrasing that's used in these opinions. I think what the courts mean in those situations is, when a law enforcement officer is part of an endeavor, and here it is a homicide investigation, and all of the Jefferson County appellants were central parts of that homicide investigation. The plaintiff has alleged that they knew that their co-investigators and actually their co-conspirators were withholding exculpatory evidence and were fabricating false evidence. And he has also alleged, not only did they do nothing when they had the opportunity to do so during the months-long investigation, but that they also participated directly as conspirators. And so that is there's no reason to protect that kind of conduct. This is not an on-the-spot, judgment that a police officer has to make in which they might be reasonably mistaken, but they make the wrong call to serve some sort of public policy ends. What we have here is homicide investigators knowing that their colleagues are fabricating false evidence, and yet they do nothing. And there's no question that these homicide investigators knew that fabricating false evidence and withholding exculpatory evidence were clearly established violations of the Constitution, and yet they did nothing. So there's no reason to protect this conduct. But we also, would ask...
Also, before you... I'm sorry, I just have to jump in here. Tell me, though, what is your best case that is factually similar to your allegations here in this context?
I think it would be, Reed v. Wren and the 10th Circuit citing Yang v. Hardin and Anderson v. Brannon.
And is that factually similar?
The rule announced in those cases is that when there's a constitutional violation and the officers have an opportunity to intervene, which there's no question.
Right, but I'm asking for a factually similar case, not the rule, but something similar factually to this case for failure to intervene. Do you have any case that is similarly on the facts, not a rule that says you can't, you can't do this, but so not concentrating on the rule, but factually.
I'm not sure that there's a one that's factually similar, but I would point the court to Taylor v. Riojas and Hope v. Pelzer. This is an obvious constitutional violation that does not, you don't need to tell a homicide investigator that you should do nothing when your co-investigators and your co-conspirators fabricate false evidence.
And did you make a version of this argument in your brief on appeal?
We did not, because we believe the district court should be able to consider this in the first instance. If the court is inclined to reach the merits of this issue, we would ask for a remand so that this court can have the benefit of the district court's reasoned analysis on a serious constitutional question.
And well, I just want to be sure I'm clear about your consent. Here it's a factual thing, so there's no nothing yay or nay, just what's fact. But you're saying that you did not make the allegation of it is so clear and obvious that we don't need prior precedent.
No, but the district court cited the authority at Appendix 902, so we would point the court there. But what the defendants are actually asking this court to do is set a rule of appellate procedure where the defendants need only utter the two words qualified immunity below, and then the district court has to go out and affirmatively anticipate and respond to every conceivable qualified immunity argument. And regardless of whether the district court does that, then the appellate court is going to consider those arguments.
There's an able district court here, but why doesn't the burden fall to you, not the district court? I mean, you look at Cox, you look at other cases, it says whose burden is triggered by the invocation of qualified immunity defense? It's plaintiff's burden. It's not the district court's burden. It's your burden.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would just retreat to, what I've said before on that point, which is that, substantive constitutional violations are what we had the burden to discuss. We didn't have the burden to anticipate every single argument that the defendants wanted to make on qualified immunity. And if I could just turn, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but could I just get, I just need to talk about Herrick for a second. What's your strongest argument of liability? And I'm not on the failure to intervene stuff now. I just want your strongest theory for liability as it relates to him.
Yes, Your Honor. For Herrig, as plaintiff pleaded in the complaint, unbeknownst to plaintiff, the true perpetrator, Tom Bledsoe, had confessed to law enforcement that he had tried to have sex with the victim in his truck, that she had laughed at him, and that he had then shot her. And Tom also indicated, which was the shovel that was used to bury the body. Despite having that information, Herrig purposefully declined to collect forensic evidence from the shovel in the truck, didn't search Tom's room or Tom's clothing or his home, while he did searches on Floyd's property. And plaintiff has alleged that that was part of this conspiracy, that as Tom Bledsoe revealed in his suicide notes, the Jefferson County police made me do it. I tried to tell the truth, but nobody would listen. There was a conspiracy here to implicate Floyd for Tom's crime. And the purposeful...
But Tom's note did not specifically implicate Herrig. It was just generally they conspiracy, not Herrig.
That's correct. It said the Jefferson County Police, but the plaintiff has alleged that Herrig supervised the day-to-day operations of this investigation, supervised Carreno, Papa, and Frost, and participated directly in evidence collection and in affirmatively in evidence collection. And then in the case of Tom's truck and Tom's shovel, and purposely did not collect that evidence.
What is your best averment that shows that Herrick was a part of the conspiracy?
That he purposefully did not collect this physical evidence.
Those are his actions, but are there any allegations that support the notion that he joined a conspiracy and agreement to do these things to incriminate Mr. Bledsoe?
Well, before discovery, the plaintiff is not in a position to say exactly who was at each meeting, but he does say that Herrick was the day-to-day supervisor of this investigation, that he participated in the investigation. And then he has a wealth of allegations that show that there was a conspiracy, which he's detailed, extensively with all kinds of conspiratorial conduct, including a meeting. He says when this conspiracy began. And then lastly, there is Tom Bledsoe's suicide note, which says the Jefferson County Police made me do it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner, you have 120.
Okay, I'd like to point the court's attention to count three, specifically what we were just talking about. It's a lot of accusations about that the officers didn't do their job well, and negligence is not a 1983 case. Count three is pled as Brady violations. failure to investigate is not a Brady violation. Brady violation must have evidence that is possessed and not produced. So there is no allegation of wrongdoing. And I particularly
it could be a failure to investigate could be a due process violation, right? Why isn't Brady just a general catch-all for due process? I mean, it's only heading in a complaint.
That is correct. I'm just pointing out it was pled as a Brady violation, and these are not Brady violations. But I understand your point. And then specific to paragraph 80 and 81 that we're just talking about, Herod is lumped in with five other people who are accused of not doing those things, not searching Tom's home, truck, or shovel. I also want to say there's no evidence beyond these allegations that show the alternate explanation is simply that these officers were just doing their job. Tom deceived everyone, including them. So we ask this court to reverse the district court and dismiss all counts against these four officers.
All right. Thank you. Well-argued case. Case is submitted.